With no fees or minimums, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than deciding to listen to another episode of your favorite podcast. And with no overdraft fees, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
That Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're gonna get across that wasteland, and we're gonna do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Bryant. And there's Jerry Whoosh Roland over there. These are just getting worse and worse.
Uh-huh.
This is Stuff You Should Know, the podcast.
Wind tunnel a dish.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad we're not in the same room so that you couldn't smell my breath when I went?
Yeah, my daughter's gotten a bad habit of doing that, and she thinks it's funny. I'm like, it's really not.
Of what?
Of, like, breathing in someone's nose on purpose, like, right in your face. I'm like, no one likes that.
Yeah. She's just entered the age of, what, 5 to 55?
Yeah,
where
I guess.
That's something people do?
Yeah, not funny ever. I tell you what, these masks that we're all wearing, that's a real reckoning with your breath, though, isn't it?
Oh, my God.
It's funny. It's like an hour-by-hour slide into despair.
You're like, I don't remember eating garlic.
Yeah, it's like in the morning, it's like, oh, man, this is great. I love this mask. And later in the day, you need that toothbrush.
Yes, it's true. They say you can't smell your own breath, and they are wrong.
And I'm brushing my teeth now more than ever because I'm scared to go to the dentist.
Yeah, same here. I'm also flossing like a mad person, too.
You're flossing right now. I can hear it.
Wow, that was the most PC thing I've ever said.
Is what?
I'm flossing like a mad person, not a madman. And technically, I guess not. I would have said like a mentally ill health person.
Yeah, that. I think that's even bad.
Who knows these days, right?
That's right. Let's talk about wind tunnels.
Okay, so we're talking wind tunnels, and I had no idea how interesting wind tunnels were. I had an inkling that there was like more to wind tunnels than people realize, which is absolutely true. But they're a deep cut.
Yeah, I mean there's way more to them, and you can do way more with them and learn way more from them than I thought, because my experience with wind tunnels, like most people, is seeing the cool TV commercial with the like green smoke flying over the car,
right,
to demonstrate how aerodynamic it is. And to be sure, that is a very big part of what they use wind tunnels for.
Yeah, yeah. And Chuck, you know, you and I were in a commercial in a wind tunnel.
I thought you might bring this up.
That was a wind tunnel, technically. That indoor skydiving thing is a type of wind tunnel. It's a vertical wind tunnel.
Yeah, if you guys haven't seen that, it's been a while since we promoted these things. We used to do these little shorts.
No, this was different.
Well, no, but these were based on those shorts.
Oh, sure, sure. Yes, yes.
Yeah, we did these little shorts that we called interstitials. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of them. And to me, it's like the best video work we've ever done as a team. I love Don't Be Dumb, but that was just you.
Oh, go on.
Well, it was great. It was you in a room, and it was this chair, and you sort of played a character.
Yes, go on.
And some people had problems with the character because they thought you were making fun of a certain kind of person.
Yes, sure, sure.
But that wasn't true. It was all very kind-hearted and just funny.
That's right. That was really great. Thank you.
Sure. And that chair is still here in the office, right?
Yes, it is. And I believe my outfit still is. I'm waiting for the Smithsonian to call.
So, yeah, we did this TV commercial for Toyota that was very much in the vein of those interstitials where we were in just all over Atlanta and various parts of Atlanta doing funny things.
That was L.A., remember?
Well, no, this, again, talking about the original interstitials.
Oh, my God, I'm so confused.
Then when we went to L.A., we did the same thing. We replicated that style in Los Angeles. And the upshot of this all is we end up in a indoor skydiving facility having a conversation like, you know, a normal conversation or trying to. That was the gig. The gig? That was the gag. That was the
both,
bit.
Really? Yeah.
And you get slung against the side of it at the end, which is kind of the funniest part.
Yeah, really. Really was. It was supposed to be an outtake, and they made it an intake,
yeah,
for sure.
Those things were very difficult to, if you've never done one before, they're, I mean, it was fun and kind of cool, but it's not easy. You don't just go in there and be like, hey, I'm floating.
No, it's really, really hard, actually.
Yeah, like you're working every muscle in your body. It's kind of like, yeah, water skiing looks fun, too.
Yeah, you were good at it. I was not very good at it.
I was okay, but it was tough.
Yeah. So that was what would be technically called a vertical wind tunnel, right?
Yeah.
And they actually use those to research spin. When something goes in a tailspin, like a helicopter goes in a tailspin, mm-hmm, they would use a vertical wind tunnel to test for that kind of thing.
Right. But the wind tunnels we kind of more think of are the horizontal tubes, mm-hmm, where you see a car or something like that having the cool smoke blown over it for a commercial.
Right.
But they're very useful. And this is something I didn't really know. I kind of just thought they were all these big giant things that you would put an actual car in. Mm-hmm. Most wind tunnels are these little desktop models that you use in a science lab,
right,
that have a scale model that you're using instead of the actual thing.
Right, which means, yeah, that you're using a smaller version, but that is precisely scaled down.
Well, it's
got to
be.
It's roughly the right size. It looks the right size, doesn't it? Quit your complaining.
I'm sure this plane will fly. This is close enough.
But what's neat about that is that they can scale this thing down. They can subject it to, you know, the same conditions as they would a full-size model, but then they can correct for the data, for the numbers they're getting, the output, they can correct to scale it back upwards, just using math. Because,
yeah,
if there's one thing that goes hand in hand with wind tunnels, it is math, friends. Because the whole point of wind tunnels is to study aerodynamics, which is the flow of air or gases over an object. And in this case, it's a stationary object and the wind is moving. But what they're really doing is simulating that object moving out there in the real world into, yeah, wind. And, I mean, that's a wind tunnel. And when you put it like that, it sounds very simple. They are not simple at all. There's really nothing about wind tunnels that's simple, from their construction to their cost to what they're used for to all of the different variables and conditions that they can test for. They grew step in step, hand in hand with the aviation industry. Like, we probably wouldn't have an aviation industry right now without wind tunnels. And that should kind of give you an idea of how complex the stuff that people are doing in wind tunnels is, or the data they're extracting from these wind tunnels tests. It's not just like, look, that cool green smoke, yeah, bending over the car. That's for yokels like you and I,
sure,
watching ads while, you know, in between golf.
Right.
You know, like you're watching golf and the ad comes on.
Sure.
My brain.
It's the best part of golf.
The ads?
No.
I've actually kind of gotten...
Are you watching golf now?
Yeah, kind of here or there. It's not something I seek out, but and it's not for the golf. I could care less about the golf. It's the views. It's the shots. The golf courses are just... They have the most amazing backdrops, and it's just so tranquil and calm. It's really something.
Yeah, you know, I live right down the street from the legendary Eastlake Country Club in Atlanta, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bobby Jones course, and I've been to one day of that one tournament. That's the only time I've actually been to a professional golf tournament.
Right.
And, you know, I stood there 12 feet from Tiger Woods in the tee box. It's pretty neat.
Wow.
Like, just to see, because I played golf a lot growing up, and it's a hard sport.
Yeah, it really is.
And to see someone do it perfectly, right, yeah, in front of your face.
Yeah.
With that much power, it was really impressive.
You know what would really help Tiger Woods' swing? If they put him in a wind tunnel, put some green smoke in the wind, and watched him swing, they could tell him how to do it better.
You want smoke? I'll give him smoke.
That's right. That's right.
Shout out to our Detroit crew from back in the day. All right. So if you want to go back in time and talk about human flight, you're going to look at things like Da Vinci's Ornithopter in 1485 and kind of a lot of early stabs at flying were humans looking at birds and thinking, well, if we're going to fly, we're going to have to learn how to flap wings really fast.
Yeah.
And it made sense, I guess. If you're looking at birds, they're the, sure, only thing flying around. It would make sense that that's where they would go. But they knew early on, regardless of the flapping, that they needed to understand wind and how wind worked with wings. And so they started going to these little hills and mountains, and they started going to caves that had, you know, they were looking for some sort of predictable constant wind.
Right.
So they could do some early testing. And they realized you just can't do it with Mother Nature. You can't get a consistent wind, mm-hmm. not enough to get real data out of it and do that math that we need so drastically to make this possible.
Right. So, and initially we got that assist from birds and that we knew wings had to be involved.
Gotta have wings.
The whole flapping thing really kind of threw things off for a while. But because we knew that there had to be wings, we knew that there had to probably be some ideal or optimum shape of wings. And that's really where wind tunnels first got their start, was in testing different shapes of wings or airfoils. And there was a guy back in 1746 named Benjamin Robbins who created a whirly arm, which is basically like a... It was a centrifuge, basically, is what he created.
Yeah, I had a hard time picturing this, and there's this one very rudimentary sketch that made it even more confusing.
Okay, so just imagine you have like a pole coming out of the ground vertically, and you have an arm attached to that pole, and the pole can spin around in a circle, like a centrifuge, like one of those G-force testers that they have in astronaut training. You know what I'm saying?
Or
one
James
of those things
Bond
that goes
movies.
Around really fast. Yeah. That thing. This is what that guy invented, but it was like with wood and in the dirt. It didn't go that fast, but you could affix a wing type that you were testing to see if it worked well to the end of it and push it through the air. And it didn't really help this guy figure out what wing style or size was the best. What it helped him figure out is that it doesn't have that much to do, if anything, with flapping. We don't need to be wasting our time inventing machines that flap their wings, because that's not it. It's all about this thing called lift and drag and the proportion between those two. And if you can figure out how to get more lift and decrease drag, then you can really make some... You can fly, basically. And this was the very first inklings of that Benjamin Robbins came up with.
Yeah, and what I saw was that Robbins really kind of pinpointed drag, like the shape is super important.
Mm-hmm.
And then after him, Sir George Cayley had his own whirling arm, and he's the one that really figured out lift was a key after they realized the shape of the thing matters. The more than the shape, like the size of it matters.
Yeah.
Size does matter.
Especially when you're flying.
Especially when you're flying. And that if you could just get a quick enough takeoff, you don't need to flap at all. All you need is a lot of speed at first, which they could have also gotten, frankly, by if they would have kept looking at birds and realized they eventually stopped flapping.
Right.
They might have realized, oh, you actually don't need to flap the whole time. You can glide if you've got enough speed.
Right. And well, actually, a lot of the early flying machines were gliders. It was when the Wright brothers were not the first people to engage in human flight. There's a monk named Elmer of Malmesbury who has the first recorded human flight back in 1050. CE, not BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, that was almost 1,000 years before the Wright brothers. But the Wright brothers are credited with an engine powered flight, human flight, right?
Sure.
So they were dabbling in what Cayley and Robbins, well, Cayley especially, had figured out that you need thrust and there's just nothing around that's light enough to produce enough thrust. So Cayley actually gave up and went and joined Parliament for a while before he finally created a flying machine 50 years before the Wright brothers.
What a loser.
He made his he made his coach driver test pilot it. And the coach driver was so scared, even though the flight was successful, that when he landed, he was like, I quit. I don't work for you anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. But George Cayley's very much overlooked figure in the history of flight. He apparently figured out the general shape of a modern airliner back in 1799.
Crazy.
Yeah.
All right. I say we take a break.
Okay.
And we'll come back and talk about the first wind tunnel right after this.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. All right, so Kaylee has these whirling arms going. Mm-hmm. Terrible name, but it worked out.
Sure.
Then enter a man named Frank H. Wyndham. He was another Englishman, and he was in the Aeronautical Society of Great Britain. And he said, gentlemen, we need a wind tunnel, and we need it bad. And so in 1871, he had the very first wind tunnel. It was 12 feet long, mm-hmm. About 18 inches square. With a 40-mile-an-hour wind, which is pretty good.
It consisted of your daughter going,
oh, God. Stinky as wind tunnel. Her breath isn't that stinky yet. Kids don't really start to stink until later, I think.
Yeah, until later.
But the winds were powered by a steam fan at the end of the tunnel, and it worked pretty well. He was able to get that leading edge of the airfoil and move it up and down and change his angle of attack and kind of see what shaped and what angles worked best with mm-hmm. To get the best lift. But it was still sort of choppy, and it was rough around the edges. And if you really want to make this, you know, if you want to fly safely, you got to have a really, really, really consistent, very smooth wind to work with to get that data. And they still didn't have one at this point.
No, they still didn't, but they were advancing by leaps and bounds here, that people were building their own wind tunnels, because up to that point, if you had a design for an airfoil, for like a wing size or shape, you had to build it and then go take it out into nature and test it and hope for the best. And it was really expensive, really time consuming. With your own wind tunnel, you could make a model of the shape and test it out yourself and then see, oh, this is actually worth pursuing, or this is junk. And that's what our dear beloved heroes, the Wright brothers, did in Ohio outside of Dayton. Orville and Wilbur Wright built their own wind tunnel. These guys were just like tinkerers. They owned a bike shop, but they were so fascinated and were following these developments in early flight that they just kind of got into it themselves. And they built themselves a wind tunnel. They had like 200 different types of wings, I believe, that they messed with, selected the 30 best ones that they had developed in their wind tunnel of their own construction and design. And apparently, I saw somewhere that by 1901, after their wind tunnel tests, the Wright brothers, couple of bicycle repairmen in Dayton, had the world's most accurate data, scientific data, on on flying and wings in the world. And they come up with it entirely by themselves.
Yeah. And here's the thing with these wind tunnels, especially early on and kind of still, it's not like they could use that wind tunnel and come out with a surefire product using math and testing different designs and shapes and tilts and angles. But it was such a time saver and broken bone saver that you didn't just say, all right, well, I think this might work. Let's go and push our cousin off of a cliff or our coach driver or whatever and see if it works. Mm-hmm. They still had their failures. All of them did.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it would have taken, I mean, God knows how many more years if they didn't, like, at least start from a point of likely success.
Yes.
Thanks to wind tunnels.
But I mean, like, look at it. They went from, they finished their wind tunnel tests in 1901. They had their first powered flight in 1903.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. 2 years.
And it definitely did accelerate it, too. And so you can see from the outset that aviation and wind tunnels just developed together, and wind tunnels developed aviation. But the first wind tunnels, like you said, they had a really big problem, and that was the air that they produced, the stream of wind, was very choppy, very turbulent, and your data was not necessarily reliable. It wasn't too terribly much better than, say, going out into Mother Nature and subjecting, you know, the same model to those winds. And that's a big problem. So one of the first things that they figured out how to do was to make the wind smoother so that you could get a reliable, smooth, steady wind in your wind tunnel whenever you wanted to use it.
Yeah, and that's where we come to the modern tunnel. Very, very smooth airflow. And they have five basic sections of, and they're, you know, they're all different, but they have five basic sections in a modern tunnel. Mm-hmm. That's the settling chamber, the contraction cone, the test section, the diffuser, and the drive section. Mm-hmm. So we start out with this swirling air, and it's a big choppy mess. And it enters the tunnel, and we'll talk about how in a second because it's kind of cool, a little counterintuitive, but it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It goes into the settling chamber, which does exactly what you think. It settles that air. It straightens it out. They might have these little honeycomb holes or a screen or these panels, and that's just sort of the initial thing to sort of get it nice and smooth.
And moving in the same uniform direction.
Yeah, and then it goes down. They step it down through that contraction cone, and that just, I mean, it's like anything else. If you make the tube smaller, it's going to increase that velocity of airflow.
Yes.
And that's where it gets to the test section, which is whatever. And the test section depends on what you're testing. If it's a desktop thing, the test section might be 12 inches long, and you might have a tiny little model of an airplane wing in there.
Right.
And that's where the actual thing you're testing is and where all the sensors are recording all the data because, you know, you've got your visual. You've got these windows so you can shoot TV commercials and you can look at the thing.
Right.
But there's also all manner of sensors to pick up on all manner of data and observations.
Yeah, I think that's really cool that they still, you know, when they operate wind tunnels, they still watch through the window.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot to be gained visually from just human beings watching this stuff.
And it's cool. You want to watch it.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Especially when they got the green smoke thing turned on.
Oh, absolutely.
So after it goes through the test section, it enters a diffuser, which kind of slows things down and maybe just exits the whole thing.
It's kind of really, the opposite of the contractor. It just opens back up.
Right, exactly. So there's a lot of different kinds of wind tunnels, as we'll see. But there's really kind of two broad categories. You've got open and closed circuit. And an open circuit is where you have wind going in on one end, going through the diffuser and the honeycomb and the test section, and then coming out the other end, blowing into the room. And another, with the closed circuit, it's just basically an oval. And so when the wind is generated, it goes through the test section out the back, but then bends around an oval track and then comes back around again and through the contraction cone and into the test section again and again and can just keep going rather than just blowing out the other side.
Yeah, and here's the part that I said wasn't intuitive, but it's really kind of neat when you think about it. Mm-hmm. The drive section is where this fan is. And this is what is just generating that airflow. And I always just thought a wind tunnel was a fan pointing at the thing.
Right.
they're actually behind the thing.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to push air onto something. You want air being pulled over something. And it just makes total sense, but you never really thought about it. I always just pictured a big fan blowing at a car.
Right.
But the fan would actually be behind the car, and it's probably looping around and smoothing out this entire way and then being gently pulled over the car.
Exactly. In just the same way that the fastest way to cool off, say, like a server room that you don't have good cooling on, you just throw a box fan the opposite way. So the box fan is blowing out into the regular room, but at the same time, it's sucking the air, the hot air out of the out of the server room, and cool air is rushing in to replace that hot air. So you're creating like an airflow that's much less turbulent. When the fan sucks the air out, it's much smoother than when it blows it in, which creates a lot more turbulence. And that was the big problem that was facing like the Wright brothers and some of those other early wind tunnel creators, is their fans were blowing on the front of their models rather than having the fan behind it sucking the air over the models.
Right. So these little models, they're kept in place. Sometimes they're on wire. Sometimes they're on these metal poles.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think the really super high-tech ones use super strong magnets to actually hold them in place, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, again, you've got all these sensors all over the place attached to the model, measuring. I mean, we'll see. It gets really, really deep. But just at the outset, you can measure like wind velocity and air pressure and temperature. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about airplanes, roll and yaw and drag and lift. And I mean, you can kind of do anything you want in there.
And if you have if you're testing an airplane or a scale model of the airplane you're going to build, it's on something called the sting, which is a pole basically that goes into the airplane's bottom, butt. But then inside the airplane's not attached to the pole. It's attached to something called a balance. And it's like all those sensors you just mentioned all in one instrument, like a cylinder or a tube. And as the airplane moves and pitches and yaws and rolls and gallops and all that stuff, not gallops, though I made that part up, it's acting on those sensors, and the motion, the mechanical motion on those sensors is translated into an electrical impulse, and that travels down the stinger into the computers, which are picking up all of this data in real time and logging it and creating new versions of the model based on that stuff. It's pretty amazing. What's even more amazing, that makes sense that that exists today. That's existed since like the 40s or the 50s in much more primitive form, but essentially the same thing that we use today, the same kind of balance, what has been around for decades.
Wasn't there a Simpsons joke about yaw control?
Yes. Yeah, when they had one of those like backyard rockets.
Oh, right.
Now with yaw control.
Yeah, that's right.
And didn't like Buzz Aldrin or something say like, wow, look at that yaw control.
Yeah, I think so. That was good stuff.
It was good.
Some other things that they measure, which you might not really think about existing, is viscosity and compressibility.
This is huge.
Or the tackiness or the bounciness of the air itself. So when you're thinking about air blowing over a car driving down the road, you don't think of that air as like being sticky necessarily. But when that air is moving over the hood of that car and the top of that car or the plane or whatever it is, those little molecules are going to hit the surface. And just very, very briefly, they're going to cling to that surface. And that even for that brief amount of time, it's going to create a little boundary layer of air next to the thing that you're trying to measure airflow over.
Yeah, which is, like I said, a very big deal. And yeah, an individual air molecule is going to stick for a nanosecond, just some ridiculously short amount of time. But there's so many air molecules that they essentially just replace each other as fast as they can move. And yes, they create this boundary layer. And as far as aerodynamics is concerned, your car driving through this wind that's sticking to it now has a different shape. That boundary layer creates a different shape or extends it outward beyond the actual physical shape of the car.
Yeah.
And so
even a tiny amount matters.
Yes, very much so. And then so when you're trying to test like how fast a car is going to go, how many miles per gallon it's going to get, that kind of stuff, that boundary layer makes a tremendous amount of difference because it changes, physically changes the shape of this thing when it's out there traveling at high speeds. So one of the great benefits of an air tunnel is you can test like what boundary layer is produced by this particular shape of this car under this condition. You know, if it's 90% humidity, but, you know, 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and they're traveling at 80 miles an hour, what kind of boundary layer is produced? Okay, well, what about 75 miles an hour at 60% humidity? You can just change all these variables, and the wind tunnel allows you to simulate it in basically get all this data in real time. Just lickety-split, basically. Although, one other thing, I just want to say this. We're making it sound like this is fast. This is actually, and has been, and especially until the age of computers, very arduous work. Because if you wanted to change one variable, if you said, well, this headlight is actually causing way too much drag, you would have to switch that headlight out with your next model and run the same tests over and over and over again with the different conditions and log all that data. So it was really arduous before computers. And you kind of get the idea that aerodynamics as a field of study is really given over to computation. Like, that has been a huge savior for that field and helped it along and saved a lot of people a lot of time.
Yeah, and you mentioned things like humidity and temperature. There are all different kinds of wind tunnels, and they can be very specific as to what they want to test or very broad. But they're all able to do things like that. You can dial in a temperature. You can dial in atmospheric pressure if you want to see what something's like on Mars, which they have to do if you want like the Mars rover to be successful.
Right.
They can ice up a plane wing just by introducing refrigerated air and spraying a mist of water that freezes and lands on the wing. And you can simulate all these different things, humidity and temperature. And it's just amazing that they thought to introduce, you know, at first they started out probably just looking at aerodynamics of flow over a thing. Mm-hmm. But as they got more and more specific with their needs, they just said, you know what, we can design these tunnels to kind of do anything we want to do, yeah, like recreate any environment you can think of, basically.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, like, as we started to build planes that go faster and faster, we started building tunnels that simulated that really high speed travel. And so we have hypersonic and supersonic wind tunnels that don't use fans at all, but they use like bursts of compressed air that blow right onto the model.
Yeah, those do blow at the thing instead of sucking behind it.
Right. But it's a huge release of air that is traveling so fast, it simulates, you know, like a jet flying through, you know, at hundreds or, you know, millions of miles an hour probably.
Yeah, or, hey, what's it like for a rocket, a human capsule to come back into Earth's atmosphere,
right,
and not burn up. Like, they can simulate those temperatures.
Yeah, there's one in, I think, North Carolina. No, University of Texas at Arlington has something that can simulate that. It goes up to 8,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's crazy, man.
It is. It's a wind tunnel. For all intents and purposes, it's a wind tunnel, but they have built these things so that they can simulate basically any climate.
And, you know, we talked about smoke, and it's always fun in those TV commercials to see the smoke blowing over the thing.
Yeah.
And it's a nice visual to sell cars that look super aerodynamic and are super aerodynamic. But that visible flow isn't just, you know, for the stoners in the lab department, like late at night to play around with.
Right.
Although they probably do that. But they flow visualization is a real technique. You might just have colored smoke. You might have liquid, like a mist of liquid. You might have, they use this colored oil sometimes, mm-hmm, that you can see like the wind pushing the oil along the surface of whatever model, right, you're using. And then they've got these high-speed cameras capturing all of it. And again, it's just, it's another variable they can actually look at rather than just using numbers and data.
Yeah, I saw one was taking photographs at like 200,000 frames per second. That's how high speed it was. But it was, they were testing like a rocket or something, or a model of it.
Should we take a break?
Yeah, let's.
All right, we'll be right back with more on wind tunnels right after this.
So
Hey everybody, Chuck here. Are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals.
Yeah, but you can drink water as clean as nature intended with Richard's Rainwater.
That's right. Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain. Richard's Rainwater is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants that are commonly found in groundwater.
And since rain is naturally pure, there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means Richard's Rainwater contains no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Just pure drops of rain.
That's right. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Perfect for sipping or mixing into your favorite cocktail. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. Enjoy pure, refreshing rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hey, everybody. If you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. So Chuck, I was like, a lot of this really breaks my brain. It's one of those things where you're like, oh yeah, I totally get this on the surface. Let me scratch a little deeper. I don't understand this at all. And the reason why is because, you know, aerodynamics requires a lot of math and formulae and all sorts of calculations that I'm not.
But you're great at that.
I'm not currently capable of doing that. But one of the things that I tried to shake down was when you do a scale model of something.
Yeah.
Do you have to scale down the conditions?
And, oh, right. Sure.
It turns out I wasn't the first one to think about this. Other people have, including people who work in wind tunnels. And apparently they do not do that. They will say subjected to the same wind speed as they would like the full size one. But then they go back and use math to adjust.
Right.
All the different variables. And again, you know, we talked about pitch, yaw, roll, drag, lift, all sorts of stuff. I'm sure quite a few things and variables that you and I haven't even come up with or run across during our research. But in each one of these interacts with each other thing, right? So it's like one of those things where, you know, you have a 11 possible toppings for a pizza, and that creates 12 million potential combinations.
It's a brain-breaking amount of math involved.
Exactly. So that's what they're doing to scale it down and scale it up. They can say, oh, well, it produced this data. If we run it through these you know, formula, like we can show that actually, like, it will have this effect in the real world. They're using that level of math.
Yeah.
Anybody who can do that with math, I admire them deeply. If you're listening out there and you can do stuff like that with math, my hat is off to you, because I will never be able to do that, and I admire you.
Yeah, and you know what? We've taken some heat for kind of beating up on math a little bit. It's like, oh, boring, because we were English and journalism guys and history guys. But I've really come to appreciate math in doing this show. Right. I'm no better at it and don't care to be. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate math is the one thing that doesn't care about what you think about it.
Right.
It doesn't care about opinions, and there's no interpretation or nuance. It's just math. And like what makes – like to look at these – to look at a math equation that would take a model of an airplane and a tiny little thing and a tiny wind tunnel and then say, well, now we just scale it up to this and this is how you do it.
Right. Just multiply by 10.
It makes me so nervous, but a real mathematician would be like, this is the last thing you should ever be nervous about, because it's just math. It's just right there.
Well, it's just – and they probably – the idea of them – of doing public speaking would probably scare the bejesus out of them. The thing is –
exactly.
– like, different things attract different people, and that's great, because that makes the world a lot more rich and complex that you have all these different people. If everyone was into math, it'd be a pretty boring place. Or if everybody hated math, it'd be a pretty boring place, too. Like, you need all different kinds. Different strokes for different folks makes the world go round, I think, is the rest of it.
All right, let's talk about some of these wind tunnels in the world, because they're amazing. NASA has one at Ames Research Center in San Jose, or near San Jose.
Biggest in the world.
Biggest one, 180 feet tall, dude, mm-hmm. 1,400 feet long. And the test section on this thing is 80 feet tall and 120 feet wide. So you can put a full-size jet plane in that thing.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, well, what kind? And they said 737. I said, all right, that's pretty good
that
size.
That kind, buddy.
Pretty good size. So yeah, that's a I don't know if they call it this, but I hear henceforth call it the Big Mamma Jamma.
Yeah, it uses six four-story high fans, mm-hmm. Each of which is powered by six 22,500 horsepower motors.
Six fans, each as tall as a four-story building.
That, man, that's amazing. 115 mile-an-hour winds is where it tops out.
Yeah, which is pretty great. That there's also a lot. Apparently,
no
I was
math.
Reading none. I was reading one. Some like blog post, I think, on like a Formula One site, and they were talking about how like every single company, every single racing team has in its facility a full-size wind tunnel. Like it can hold a full-size Formula One car at the cost of like $60 to $100 million or whatever. But they are like cutting edge as far as aerodynamic study is concerned. And the reason why is because like if you can shave a second off of somebody's time just by reconfiguring the shape of a fin or a tail or something like that, that's it just paid for itself, basically, because it may have just won like the Indy 500.
Name one. Okay. Good job.
There you go. Thank you.
So there are NASCAR's obviously got a couple of these things in North Carolina, the home of NASCAR, Aeroden Wind Tunnel. That is in North Carolina, and it tests full-size stock cars. There's another one called Windshear there. This is a closed-circuit tunnel that actually has a treadmill in it for cars. It's got a built-in rolling road.
Yeah,
pretty
I saw
neat.
That in a few places. Like BMW has one.
Oh, I'm sure.
with the rolling road. You know, what's interesting to me, too, is so we saw that the aviation industry and wind tunnels kind of grew hand in hand. The auto industry didn't really look up wind tunnels until about the 50s is when they really started running their cars through those kind of paces.
And they went, boy, these cars are not aerodynamic.
No, look at it. Look at that yaw control, though.
Yeah, I love those old cars, though. My old Plymouth Valiant that I used to have.
Yeah.
This is obviously way before anyone ever thought of anything like anti-lock brakes. Uh-huh. And one of the most fun things I would do when I was driving with friends on an empty road late at night was get up to about 50 miles an hour and just slam on the brakes.
Jeez.
It was so much fun, man. It was great. You would just go... You would slide about 100 feet before finally coming to a rest.
That was a great impression of slamming on the brakes, too, by the way.
It was good. And, you know, it was like we called it the sled because it was just this big, heavy hunk of metal. It's not like I was sliding all over the road. I was just sliding very straight in a line.
What's the opposite of aerodynamic?
That Plymouth Valiant.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sluggish, like a wet sponge.
Yeah, that's about right.
So I think we should wrap this up on the future of wind tunnels, because people have been saying, like, well, wind tunnels are dead now. We've got computational fluid dynamics, which is basically computers can figure all this out. If you put a shape into, you know, AutoCAD and say, computer, figure out what, you know, will happen if I try to fly this under these conditions, it'll tell you. People have said, well, you know, it takes a lot of work and a lot of money to run and build and use wind tunnels. So I think they're probably going away. People who work in wind tunnels say, no, do not do away with the wind tunnels. We need them still. Because, yes, computation helps a lot with the early work. But when you finally have something that you need to prove, you really kind of want to see it in real life.
You want to see that
smoke. To make sure. Yeah, you want to see that smoke yourself. And you know, computer simulations can't simulate green smoke very well. You got to see that in real life. So they're saying that this is complementary technology, and that they really, we need to keep our wind tunnels around because we still need them.
Yeah, and I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't say it's not just vehicles and seeing how like a space shuttle or a car or a plane or a dune buggy might run in the wind. If you want to see how airflow affects like a computer and components in a computer, you can do that.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Like how they cool computer chips. If you want to figure out the very best design for a wind turbine or a wind farm, then you can use air tunnels. There are lots of other different uses that you don't think about just on kind of everyday products sometimes.
Yeah, at Virginia Tech, there's an anechoic, I believe, wind tunnel where they test wind turbines to see what kind of noise they're going to make. And they have, so the walls are, as far as the wind is concerned, it has four walls. But as far as sound is concerned, it has three. Because one of the walls is made of Kevlar. So wind won't go through it, but sound will go right through it like it's not even there. So they can take accurate measurements of what's going to happen when the wind hits this turbine. What kind of sound is it going to make? And they're making the country folk who live among wind turbines much happier.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's it for wind tunnels, everybody. There's probably more to it, but it's far, far beyond Chuck's or my grasp. So, again, hats off to all the aerodynamicists and all of their maths.
Agreed.
If you want to know more about wind tunnels, go check stuff out on the internet. I hear there's a man with a pageboy haircut who does a pretty mean demonstration of one.
No.
No?
No, that's just the printing press.
Oh, okay. I thought he was a factotum.
He might be.
Renaissance man. Well, since I said Renaissance man, everybody, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this on wetlands, and this is one from Brian from Queens. And this is very cool. I didn't realize this. There was a music venue in New York when I used to live up in New Jersey called Wetlands that I would go to, and I never knew there was kind of a cool story behind it. And now I do. So this is from Brian, and he says, you know, the New York City area is surrounded by salt marshes, and there are tons of ordinances protecting New York City's natural flood and pollution guards, as you describe them. In the 90s and throughout the 80s and 90s at the Wetlands Preserve, it was an activist nightclub named for the land that Lower Manhattan was built on. The club was on Hudson in Tribeca, very much downtown Manhattan, which back in the early settlement by the Dutch was, and subsequent takeover by the English, was all salt marshes. Wetlands Preserve, colloquially referred to as the Wetlands, was opened from 89 to 2001. Dual purpose was to create an earth-conscious, intimate nightclub that would nurture live music integrated with a full-time environmental and social justice activist center in the club's basement.
Wait, what was the years it was open?
89 to 2001.
There is a 100% chance that Jewel played there.
He doesn't list Jewel, but I bet she did.
Okay, whoa, he lists some people.
He lists a few, but he also links to many more, and she's probably in there.
Okay.
I think I saw Ween there, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, cool.
But he said downstairs, activists planned protests, made pamphlets, wrote letters to politicians and lobbies, generated boycotts, and educated club patrons, while upstairs, we hosted, or they hosted some formative performances for legendary rock bands like Pearl Jam, Dave Matthews, Maroon 5, Oasis, Widespread
Panic.
And let's
not forget Jewel.
Fish, Rise Against, Fishbone, Bikini Kill, Blind Melon, and Jewel.
Just kidding. Yes.
The nightclub raised revenue for the Activism Center's efforts, and in turn, the Activism Center staff and volunteers educated nightclub patrons on environmental, social justice, and animal rights issues through posters, educational displays, literature, etc., and film screenings. The New York-based Wetlands Activism Collective continues. The club is shut down, but they continue its environmental, social, and political activism to this day. And that is from Brian Stollery.
Nice, Brian. That's pretty great.
Never knew that. I think I went to a couple of shows at Wetlands.
Oh, you did?
And I never knew that there was something else going on there, and I kind of had forgotten about it.
I wonder if when you show up, they're like, it's a cop's cop. Don't tell them it's in the basement.
Narc.
That was Brian, you said?
Yeah, Brian Stollery.
That's pretty cool. Thanks for filling in the blanks for us there, Brian. And if you want to be like Brian and fill in some blanks for us, you can send us an email. Send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, everybody, are you thirsty? Well, sip on pure, refreshing Richard's Rainwater. Yes, it's really rain, caught clean before it hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's Rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of Richard's still rainwater or the long-lasting and cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. Sip the sky.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.